Well, get ready. It's like a brand new show. Graham Hancock with us now as we talk about his work, Magicians of the Gods, and I'll be back with Graham, and you will love what you're going to hear in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Graham Hancock back with us. He's become recognized as one of the thinkers who raises questions about humanity's history and prehistory, offering popular challenges to the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars, graduated from Durham University, and he is the author of a number of books, including his latest, Magicians of the Gods. Graham, welcome back, my friend. Good to have you.
Hi, George. Good to be back with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about any travels coming up for you?
Yeah, not for a while. I spent most of last year on the road, and I'm going to be back on the road from the month of May onwards in America, because my next big book, the book that I'm working on now, is about mysterious ancient America. So I'm going to be spending 2 months on the road in the United States and a bit of it in Canada as well, through May and June. So that's the next big trip coming up.
Okay, and I trust I'll run into you at some event somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think you're going to be at Contact, right?
Yeah, I will be there. Absolutely.
You bet. I'll be there, too. That's, I think, the 19th of May or something like that.
Last year, we celebrated my birthday there, remember?
Oh, yes. That was fun. Well, I'll look forward to seeing you at Contact then, for sure.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that. Now, back in 1995, you thundered through the world with Fingerprints of the Gods. Let's give us a little synopsis of that work first, because that is obviously so important to Magicians of the Gods.
Yeah, indeed. I think Fingerprints of the Gods, without a doubt, is the book for which I'm best known. And the reason for that is that the book, mysteriously to me, I hadn't expected it at all, but it just took off like a rocket. It seemed to touch a nerve back in 1995 when it was published, and in many countries. I mean, for example, it was a number one bestseller in Japan for 6 weeks.
My gosh.
Ended up selling more than 2 million copies in hardback in Japan. And that with a small publisher who had, almost nothing to invest. It took them by surprise, everybody by surprise. But there was a feeling in the air back in 1995 that something was wrong with history. And it was that precise issue that I had investigated in Fingerprints of the Gods, doing 3 years of research and finally bringing the book out in 1995, that something's wrong with the story we're being told about our past. And the further back we go, the more wrong the story sounds. In other words, recent history, where we have detailed documents and records, the last 300-400 years, you know, the historians have probably got it pretty much right. And even going back to Roman and Greek times, yes, there's lots and lots of documents that they can draw on to build their theories and ideas of the past. And as we go back further into ancient Egypt, that, of course, was a literate culture with a vast literature that helps us to understand them. And the same with Sumer in Mesopotamia. But then when you get back before 5,000 years ago, before around 3,000 BC, which is 5,000 plus years ago, when you get back beyond that horizon, the documents dry up. There are no more. You might find a few sort of what they call proto-texts, and then there's no text, nothing at all. And all that archaeologists have to go on is their excavations and their own ideas and theories that they bring to the project. And a fundamental idea rooted deeply in archaeologists is that there was no such thing that can be called a civilization on Earth until around 5,000 years ago, with ancient Egypt and ancient Sumer, mm-hmm. and perhaps the beginnings of ancient China. And that is deeply rooted. So what I was suggesting in Fingerprints of the Gods is, I think we've missed a whole episode in the human story. The Ice Age, which covered the Earth from in massive ice sheets, North America and Northern Europe under two, large parts of North America and Northern Europe under 2 miles of ice. This lasts for 100,000 years, and then it cataclysmically melts down, creating truly global floods. And that's when it seemed to me that we need to focus. We need to look at this period of turmoil and chaos and disturbance and the myths that come down to us from the past and consider the possibility. Are we a species with amnesia? Have we forgotten an episode of high civilization that existed in the past? And the answer I come to is, yes, we have. We've lost a whole civilization, and I present the evidence, the fingerprints of that civilization in my book, Fingerprints of the Gods, back in 1995.
Now, did this civilization get any ET help?
I can't rule that out. I've never you know, really strongly advocated the ancient alien hypothesis. That does not mean that I'm against or a disbeliever in ET contacts and ET connections. Of course, the universe is full of life. It would be crazy to imagine otherwise. I'm very open to the possibility that we have had ET contacts down the ages. But can I see evidence for an extraterrestrial civilization in the ancient monuments and cultures that I've studied around the world? And the answer is no, not really. What I see is evidence for a higher level of human civilization than we thought we had. And you know, to give you an example, there are tiny errors in the construction of the Great Pyramid. If an alien civilization had been, and the Great Pyramid is often cited as an example, if an alien civilization had navigated across interstellar space and arrived at planet Earth and taken it upon themselves to build or have the locals build a pyramid, they wouldn't have made those tiny, tiny errors. The Great Pyramid is incredibly precise. It's far beyond the abilities attributed to the ancient Egyptians at that time. But I think the best answer is we're looking at human error, and we're looking at a legacy of knowledge from a lost high civilization of prehistoric antiquity.
I think so, too. What happened
to it? George, just to say that therefore, I don't think that the ancient monuments and ancient archaeological sites are good evidence for the extraterrestrial contact hypothesis.
Right.
I think there's a lot better evidence than that.
Okay, what do you think happened to these civilizations, ancient civilizations, with incredible technology, human technology? What happened to them?
Well, the plain answer to that is that we have an episode of unbelievable cataclysm between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. And this is why I've gone on to write Magicians of the Gods, because that was precisely the period that I focused upon in Fingerprints of the Gods. But there was at that time, back in 1995, much less scientific evidence about the nature of that cataclysm than we now have. And new research done since the mid-2000s has really clarified the picture enormously. And this episode is called the Younger Dryas. It's been known by geologists for a long time. It kicks in 12,800 years ago with a radical plunge in global temperatures, puzzlingly accompanied by global flooding and sea level rise. This freezing period, really desperate cold, lasts for 1,200 years. And then 11,600 years ago, temperatures shoot up at just an unbelievable rate. There are further enormous floods and sea level rise. And it's only after that that archaeology begins to pick up the story. So what I'm interested in is what happened before. Is it possible that this cataclysmic episode accounts not only for the global myths and stories of global cataclysm and flood, but also for the stories of a great advanced human civilization of prehistoric antiquity, which angered the gods and was destroyed? And it's that new evidence that I'm going into at length in Magicians of the Gods.
And great evidence as well. So let's jump into the sequel, Magicians of the Gods. Were there specific things you saw that led you to want to write this sequel?
Well, yes, absolutely. The first issue is the new focus on the nature of the cataclysm between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. Now, maybe we haven't got it all entirely disentangled yet. Maybe there are nuances and issues that need to be resolved. But the work of a group of more than 30 geophysicists and geological scientists since 2007 has strongly, strongly indicated that the Earth was bombarded by the fragments of a giant comet, the same sort of comet that hit Jupiter in 1994, which broke up into 20 fragments. And when those fragments hit Jupiter, the explosions were larger than the Earth itself. Something like that happened in our solar system 12,800 years ago. A comet entered, broke up into multiple pieces, and at least four of those pieces hit the Earth 12,800 years ago. And the evidence to me suggests that we had a further encounter with other fragments of that same comet 11,600 years ago. So it's the comet with the impact on the ice cap the North American ice cap primarily 12,800 years ago that initiates the Younger Dryas and brings in this incredible plunge in temperatures, which is accompanied by massive extinctions of animal species all around the world. And I think it's a comet, further fragments of the same comet, because these comets break up into hundreds of fragments, some of them a mile across. I think it's a further encounter with fragments of that comet 11,600 years ago, this time with the primary impact being in an ocean, that account for the sudden global warming and flooding that occurs then. The oceanic impact throws up a huge cloud of water vapor into the upper atmosphere, enshrouds the Earth, and creates a greenhouse effect that would account for the warming. Now, the science on the end of the Younger Dryas is not as good as the science on the beginning. And this is where I think it's important to pay tribute to very important work being done by Professor Robert Schock at Boston University.
Good man. Good man.
A good man. And a friend of mine and a wonderful colleague and an incredibly brave and detailed, thorough researcher. And Robert Schock and I both absolutely agree on the cataclysmic nature of the Younger Dryas, that global temperatures plunged 12,800 years ago, that they shot up 11,600 years ago. But Robert Schock thinks that the agent for this was the sun.
Right. You two disagree on the cause.
We do. We disagree on the cause, but not on the effects. And actually, I wouldn't call it such a profound disagreement on this issue at all, because Robert Schock's focus is primarily on 11,600 years ago. And there's very good reasons for that. And what happened 11,600 years ago, as I said a few moments ago, the comet science on that is not nearly as good as the comet science on what happened 12,800 years ago. So I'm open to Robert Schock's idea of coronal mass ejections being responsible for the sudden global warming and flooding 11,600 years ago, although I think we must investigate the possibility of a second bombardment of impacts from the same comet that hit us 12,800 years ago. But I don't think coronal mass ejections explain the sudden freeze 12,800 years ago, or indeed the horrific evidence of flooding across North America that Randall Carlson and I investigated and that I report in Magicians of the Gods. So Schock and I are absolutely on the same page that we're dealing with a huge cataclysmic episode that lasted 1,200 years, Jeez. In which it's highly likely that an advanced civilization was lost from the Earth.
I'm sorry, Greg. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that more work needs to be done on the issue of the exact agency of what happened 11,600 years ago. But I'm as sure as I can be, based on leading geophysicists and geologists who specialize in this field, that we are dealing for sure with a massive series of comet impacts. Fragments of a single comet, at least four of them, hitting the North American ice cap 12,800 years ago, causing large quantities of that ice to melt down and flood south across the channeled scablands of the Pacific Northwest. The channeled scablands were created by that flood, and plunging the Earth into an incredible deep freeze that lasted 1,200 years and resulted in enormous animal extinctions. What's fascinating about the next date, the date of 11,600 years ago, when global temperatures shoot up and when again we have flooding, is that that is precisely the date that Plato gives us for the destruction and submergence by flood of the great advanced lost civilization of Atlantis.
Yes, I was just going to ask you that. And today, ironically, Graham, scientists have reported that there may be a downed continent in the Indian Ocean.
Yes, that's right. Under Madagascar, I've just been looking at those reports. It's quite intriguing. Of course, they're tracing that back billions of years, not of the order of hundreds of thousands of years, where our focus should be. But what it tells us is that we are constantly finding out new things about the Earth. That the science is constantly changing. And no scientific position, no position can be held, particularly regarding the human past, can be held as absolutely final and finished and done with. We have not closed our accounts with our own past. There is a gigantic mystery in our own past, and we are learning each day something new about the story of our Earth, something new about the cosmic environment in which we live and something new about our past, because it wasn't only the evidence for cataclysm 12,800 to 11,600 years ago that led me to write Magicians of the Gods, but also a whole host of new archaeological discoveries, of which by far the most important is the incredible, almost 12,000-year-old megalithic site of Göbekli Tepe in Turkey,
mm-hmm.
which just comes out of nowhere and is a giant archaeological mystery.
And how do you explain that? How does anybody explain that?
Well, first of all, I can tell you what the archaeologists are saying. Up until the discovery of Göbekli Tepe in the mid-1990s, just after I published Fingerprints of the Gods, up until the discovery of Göbekli Tepe, it was the view of archaeologists that megaliths, stone circles, the great megalithic temples of Malta, and so on and so forth, that these kind of constructions were the work of what is called the Neolithic period. Archaeologists call it the Neolithic, the New Stone Age. Roughly, the oldest, according to the archaeological view, would be 5,000, maybe 5,500 years old. And they said they could understand how communities could get together to build these giant constructions 5,000 years ago, because by then there was established agriculture, creating surpluses, allowing specialists to emerge, for example, architects and engineers who could focus on the placing and the raising of the huge stones. What archaeologists would not countenance was the possibility of megalithic culture earlier than that, when our ancestors were just hunter-gatherers. How could hunter-gatherers develop these skills and have the surpluses that would allow specialists to emerge? So, as we say in England, the archaeologists were gobsmacked when Göbekli Tepe turned up, literally as though they'd been punched in the mouth, because Göbekli Tepe, firmly and absolutely dated by the German Archaeological Institute itself, is 11,600 years old. It emerges in an area where there were only hunter-gatherers prior to that, and then suddenly we have this giant megalithic site, and it is in fact the largest megalithic site on Earth, because more than 50 times as much than has already been excavated is still under the ground. This huge megalithic site suddenly appears in Turkey, incredibly skilled, incredibly polished. It contains the world's first perfectly north-south aligned structure, which means astronomers were involved. And at the same moment, agriculture suddenly appears in the same area. And what archaeologists are saying sounds to me like a fairy tale. They're basically saying a group of hunter-gatherers woke up one morning, equipped with all the skills to create the largest megalithic site on Earth, 7,000 years before Stonehenge, and at the same moment, they also invented agriculture. I think that's crazy. I think we're looking at absolute evidence of a transfer of technology from the survivors of a lost civilization to the hunter-gatherers they settled amongst in Turkey.
And in terms of Göbekli Tepe, quickly describe what it looks like to people. We can get pictures, of course.
Yes, series of megalithic pillars arranged in circles and ovals. These pillars can be as much as 20 feet high. They are cut from solid rock, and they are roughly T-shaped. In fact, they're anthropomorphic. Most of them have arms and hands carved into them, with the hands meeting in a very interesting way in front of the belly, and the top of the T appears to represent the head of some kind of being. And so they're arranged in circles, but roughly five of those circles have been excavated so far. But the German Archaeological Institute have been over the whole site with ground-penetrating radar, and their conclusion is that 50 times as much remains unexcavated beneath the ground.
That's amazing. Graham, we're going to take a quick break, but we will be right back. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Graham Hancock with us. We'll take phone calls next hour with Graham as we talk about his new work, Magicians of the Gods, The Forgotten Wisdom of Earth's Lost Civilization. With this calamity in place, Graham, why don't we have any artifacts in terms of structures of their houses and things like that?
Well, precisely because of the calamity. We have to understand how radically the face of the Earth changed. We have to understand that sea level rose 120 feet at the end of the Ice Age, flooding vast areas of land. In fact, more than 10 million square miles of land was above water during the Ice Age, that is underwater now. That's roughly the size of Europe and China added together. It's just missing from the picture because the archaeological picture that has been built up relies very little on what's called marine archaeology. And when marine archaeologists are involved, they're primarily looking for shipwrecks under the sea. They don't, their concept of the past does not allow them to consider the possibility that there might have been a prehistoric advanced civilization that was affected by those rapidly rising sea levels at the end of the last ice age. Climate changed very radically. Where we have the Amazon jungle today, more than 12, 13,000 years ago, we had a kind of open garden parkland. Now completely covered in jungle, and the tragic clearances of the Amazon are beginning to reveal huge prehistoric earthworks, stone circles, and the like. The Sahara Desert was green 12,000 years ago, and is an absolutely inhospitable wilderness today. Very little archaeology has been done in the Sahara Desert because, again, the archaeologists ask themselves, why should we bother? We know that there was no civilization 12,000 years ago, but they don't know that. That's just a prejudice which actually goes against the myths and memories of mankind, such as we have them. And then the ice sheets themselves, ground down to powder, anything that was beneath them before they formed, the ice sheets were 2 miles deep. I mean, consider the weight of the ice, the pressure on the Earth's surface. Everything underneath that ice is just pulverized, literally pulverized. And then when the ice comes off, and we see this particularly dramatically in North America, you get these massive floods rolling south into areas that were not covered by ice. And that's why anybody who would like to actually see this for themselves, I strongly urge you to go visit the channeled scablands in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State. Just absolutely stunning landscapes that speak eloquently of a huge cataclysm of flood that rolled over this landscape and created the landscape as we see it. Boulders weighing 18,000 tons that were carried there in icebergs the size of oil tankers, grounded on the side of hills as the flood rushed through, stuck on those hills. As the flood receded, the iceberg was left there, the ice melted away, and now you have this huge, what's called glacial erratic, and there are thousands of them sitting across the Pacific Northwest. I mean, the mind boggles when you consider the magnitude of the cataclysm that this area went through, and it's really not surprising that very little is left. But perhaps the most important answer to your question is the archaeologists aren't looking for it because they don't believe it's there. And that's where I and Professor Robert Schonk at Boston University, John Anthony West, Robert Boval, and others who've been working away in this field for the past 25 years have, I think, something to contribute, an alternative human story that archaeology should be considering. I think it's a pity that archaeologists are so rigid and closed-minded about the past. We've seen this in America, you know, with the whole model of the peopling of the Americas. For decades, archaeologists were absolutely adamant that there were no human beings in America before 13,000 years ago. It was called the Clovis First model. Anybody who proposed an earlier site was ridiculed, attacked, humiliated by the archaeological community, including archaeologists themselves. And then, lo and behold, what do we discover? The DNA evidence proves it. New discoveries prove it. Of course, America was inhabited for thousands, tens of thousands of years before 13,000 years ago. And archaeologists are now having to, you know, admit this. But a rigid model held back the truth for decades.
Graham, who was the late Klaus Schmidt?
Klaus Schmidt, in my opinion, was a really great man. He was effectively the discoverer of Göbekli Tepe. And he was because he passed away in 2014, a professor with the German Archaeological Institute. Now, when I say the discoverer, let me tell you a little bit about this, because actually Göbekli Tepe, in the Turkish language, the words Göbekli Tepe mean pot-bellied hill. And indeed, that is what was presented to the eye, to anybody who visited this area, was a peculiar-looking pot-bellied hill.
And was it all underground? Was it covered?
It was all underground at that time.
Okay.
And what happened was a group of archaeologists, actually American archaeologists in the 1960s, did visit the site. And they noticed a carved pillar jutting out of the ground. In fact, it was the top of one of these T-shaped pillars. But the carving was so good The work was so excellent that they concluded it must have dated to the Byzantine period, that it was probably a Byzantine cemetery, maybe less than 1,000 years old. And since they were interested, that those archaeologists were looking for Stone Age material, they said, no, this isn't for us. This is much too recent. The work couldn't have been done in our period. So they just ignored the site. And the site then was not looked at again until Klaus Schmidt went back there and took a thorough look at that pillar sticking out of the ground and began to dig, and lo and behold, discovered this gigantic complex there. And the amazing and mysterious thing is that that gigantic complex was created 11,600 years ago, exactly the date that Plato gives for the destruction of Atlantis, exactly the date for the second cataclysm at the end of the Younger Dryas. It was created then. It ran for about 1,000 years. It functioned for about 1,000 years, during which we see agriculture blossom mysteriously in that area. And then it was shut down. Whoever created it buried it, deliberately buried it, covered it in hundreds of thousands of tons of rubble and stones, filled up those stone circles, and didn't stop there. They went on and created that pot-bellied hill. It's entirely artificial over the top of it. And that's why we can be so sure of the dating, because dating megalithic sites is difficult. There is no really objective test to date when a piece of stone, a megalith, was cut. What you have to do is date organic material that's found in association with that stone. This is called carbon dating. Carbon dating only dates organic material. Therefore, you are concluding that the raising up and the cutting of the stone date from the same time as the piece of bone or charcoal that you found near it that you've dated. And that conclusion can often be wrong. In megalithic sites that have been open to the elements that have been walked over and even reused by later cultures, you get the possibility of falsely young dates being introduced to the site by a later culture, unless you have a sealed site. And that's what we have at Göbekli Tepe. That site was deliberately buried more than 10,000 years ago. And it then was untouched and unseen by any human being until Klaus Schmidt opened it up in the mid-1990s.
Was this buried to hide it from us, and why?
This is an answer that we don't have yet. We don't know why Göbekli Tepe was buried. It was a deliberate action. That is the only thing for certain. This site was not covered by natural sedimentation. We have to envisage teams of hundreds of people, effectively, with buckets.
So there wasn't like an impact that covered it?
No, it was very carefully covered to preserve it. It wasn't like some invading army came in and smashed it up and buried it either. It was beautifully, neatly done. The site was carefully interred. You know what? I think it's a time capsule. I think it was interred as a time capsule, and I await with awe the results of further excavations on that site, the remaining effectively 90% of the site that is still underground. I don't know what that is going to tell us about our past. It's just a tragedy. That area is now very difficult to work in because of the problems in neighboring Syria, which is, you know, almost within eyeshot.
Could it be the Hall of Records, something that Robert Bovall and John Anthony West would get their teeth into?
Yeah, I think it is a hall of records. I actually think there are many halls of records around the world, and that these halls of records primarily take the form of giant megalithic constructions, sometimes underground, which preserve scientific information to be passed down to the future. But we need to do much more work, much more excavation at Göbekli Tepe and at many other sites. There's another intriguing site in Indonesia where we have what looks like a 20,000-year-old pyramid. And again, frustratingly, archaeological work has been stopped there. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but the way that every time we get what looks like the beginnings of a real breakthrough in opening our eyes to the past, something mysterious happens to stop it. It was the same at the Great Pyramid when Rudolf Gantenbrink sent his little robot up those shafts in the Great Pyramid back in 1993. I mean, he was then kicked off the site and it was taken over by the Egyptian authorities. It was the same when John Anthony West and Robert Schock did the seismic work around the Sphinx around about 1991 or 1992. Again, they were kicked off the site and not allowed to continue with the work. And what has been happening since then, we're simply not told. Can I say now, since we're mentioning John Anthony West, one of the great thinkers of this field, I'd just like to alert your listeners to the fact that John Anthony West is suffering from advanced cancer.
I had heard something about
that. Yes, it's a tragic. I was with John in the beginning of December in New York, and in fact, we did an on-stage conversation together, which was recorded and filmed, and it's on YouTube. If anybody goes to my website, grahamhancock.com, they can see the link on the first page of the site to that video and the link to John's crowdfunding page, because we who are his friends, and John, so much love is rightly born to John all around the world. He has been really the radical scholar who has stuck his neck out for decades and has opened this field up. It was John's insight that brought Professor Robert Schoch to Giza in the early 1990s to look at the erosion patterns of the Sphinx. John was the first person to see that there was something seriously wrong with the Sphinx. He's been a radical, outspoken critic of the mainstream archaeological position, and he's so funny and brings so much to the point. He really helps us to think clearly about the past. So I think the time now is for us to rally round and support John Anthony West. He's not going the mainstream medical route.
He's going to the Brzezinski Clinic, isn't he?
He's gone to the Brzezinski Clinic. He's there now, and John needs our help. So I'm urging people to go to. First of all, go to my website, look on the first page down at the bottom. You'll see John's picture and a link, and that can take you then to the video and to the crowdfunding page. And, you know, if just give $5, $10, as long as enough of us do it, we'll be able to get John through this treatment and give him, you know, dignity and a measure of the love and support that he has rightly earned.
Oh, that's kind of upsetting, though, I got to tell you, Graham.
It's very sad. I'm finding it hard to imagine this field without John Anthony West. And John is 84 years old, and I just hope he goes on for at least another 20 years.
Exactly.
And beats this cancer.
He's got a great mind.
He's a great mind and a really remarkable human being and a very radical, open-minded thinker. And we need people like
Yes,
John.
We do.
We need to show our appreciation.
I mean, I'm sure if he goes, he wants to get locked in a pyramid or something like that and be hidden
well,
that way.
John has been deeply immersed in the ancient Egyptian, the mysterious ancient Egyptian texts, for most of his working life. If anybody is psychically and spiritually prepared for the world beyond, I would say it is John. But we want him with us for a lot longer. So let's get out there and support him.
And throw some prayers his way, too. A number of prayers, too. Tell me about the pyramids and the fact that they're being discovered all around this planet.
Yeah, I mean, they keep on
popping up.
Often, to the surprise of archaeologists, the site that I mentioned in Indonesia, which is called Gunung Padang, looked like another one of those pot-bellied hills, actually, to archaeologists. They just thought it was a hill. Oddly enough, there was a megalithic site on top of it. Nobody really bothered to date that megalithic site, but the assumption was that it was about 2,000, 2,500 years old. I mean, old, but not very old, not very special. This was the general feeling amongst archaeologists in Indonesia until an outsider comes into the field, actually a geologist, he's Indonesia's leading expert in megathrust earthquakes, actually. He's a highly, highly qualified geologist, but with an interest in archaeology. And he takes a look at this hill, and he doesn't think it's a hill. It looks too regular, too structured. It feels man-made to him, and he has the equipment to check this out. So he and his geologist colleagues, they bring in remote sensing equipment, ground-penetrating radar. They bring in seismic equipment. They run electrical resistivity lines down the side of this so-called hill. And lo and behold, it turns out to be a man-made pyramid with a megalithic site on top of it. And as the drill cores go down deeper and deeper, we get pieces of worked stone coming up with datable organic material and fabulous dates that go back to the depths of the last ice age, to 20,000 years or more ago in the past, when places like Indonesia would have been the best habitable land on Earth, you know. And so it's fascinating and intriguing that that site is there. I think it's one of the key important pyramid sites in the world today. And again, since 2014, there was a change of government in Indonesia. And since then, work on that site has been absolutely stopped.
Oh,
no appeals have led to the resumption of that work. There are pyramids all over China. As is well known, of course, I've visited the pyramids in Xi'an province. There are hundreds of them. I mean, literally hundreds.
Right. Bosnia has pyramids.
I've been to Bosnia. I've been shown around the so-called Pyramid of the Sun and the other pyramids, Pyramid of the Moon, the Love Pyramid, and so on by Samos Magic. I'm not convinced, I have to say. I'm not convinced. I think in Bosnia, unless new evidence comes out, I remain open-minded. I decided not to cover the so-called Bosnian pyramids in my work in Magicians of the Gods because I am, as a researcher who's been working in the field for a very long time, I am not persuaded by the evidence. The so-called...
What do they look like to you? Just mounds?
No, they look like natural hills. I think the
Pyramid of the Sun
is a perfectly natural hill. The impression is given that there are tunnels and passageways within it, but that's not the case. The passageways are more than 2 kilometers away from the Pyramid of the Sun, the Ravna tunnels. They are very low tech, and I see nothing special about them. They could be the work of medieval miners. I don't know, but I don't see anything that convinces me we're dealing with a truly ancient prehistoric man-made site in Bosnia. And I fear that it's a distraction from the real work that needs to be done on sites like Göbekli Tepe and Gunung Padang, where there is absolutely firm, compelling, and irrefutable evidence that we are dealing with archaeological sites through and through. I remain open. If Samos Magic and his team come up with really convincing evidence rather than just the appearance of things in a few low-tech tunnels miles away from the so-called pyramids, then I will be ready to listen. And I hope they're right, but I don't want to weaken my argument by introducing into it material that can easily be discredited.
Don't comets, Graham, historically come back after a certain amount of time?
Yes, they do. And indeed, the myth of the phoenix, the story of the phoenix, may have something very much to do with comets. What goes around
comes around.
And in fact, the debris field of the comet that caused so much damage 12,800 years ago is still in orbit in our solar system. And the Earth crosses that debris field twice every year, for 12 days in June and for 12 days in November. And that debris field is still full of large rocks, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of that fragmented giant comet. It's known to astronomers. It's called the Taurid meteor stream. It's 30 million kilometers wide. It takes the Earth 12 days to pass through it. To my mind, it's like strapping on a blindfold and crossing an 8-lane interstate twice a year and just hoping we don't hit any heavy traffic.
Graham, could it be the Planet X that so many people talk about? We'll talk about that with you and take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.